Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
The vast and vibrant world of biblical commentary has, over the generations, shaped not only our understanding of the Tanakh, but Judaism's worldview and values as well. The biblical commentator, or parshan, is a spiritual seeker proposing answers to the theological and existential questions raised by the text and serving as mediator between Tanakh and the reader. In her widely hailed work, Great Biblical Commentators, Dr. Abigail Rock of Blessed Memory gives us a groundbreaking study that surveys over 20 of the greatest biblical exegetes in the course of Jewish history. Beginning with Onkelos, continuing with leading medieval commentators such as Rashi, Ibn Ezra, and Ramban, and Aharonim such as Malbim and Netziv, and ending with influential 20th century commentators. It includes discussions of the commentators' exegetical methods, their interactions with their historical period and environment, and their contributions to the world of exegesis. Through exploration of the commentators' biographies and methodologies, and enriched by carefully chosen and insightful examples from their works, Abigail Rock contextualizes and illuminates their philosophies while giving us a glimpse into their masterful thought and analyses. Join us as we speak with Abigail Rock's brother, Avraham Popko, about his sister's rich legacy in Torah teaching and her recently published book, Great Biblical Commentators. You're listening to New Books in Jewish Studies, a channel of the New Books Network, and I'm your host, Michael Morales. Rabbinate Dr. Abigail Popko Rock was a prominent lecturer and educator in the field of Tanakh and its exegesis. Dr. Rock received her PhD from the Tanakh Department of Bar-Ilan University for her thesis on the biblical exegete Rav Yosef Ibn Kaspi. She was one of the first women licensed as a rabbinical advocate and taught at the Institute for Rabbinical Advocates. Due to her unique skill in deriving inspirational, educational messages from literary and exegetical analysis, Abigail Rock was a sought-after lecturer and a source of inspiration for students all over the world. Her untimely passing at the age of 48 left her family and community bereft of her teachings, sage advice, and unfailing good humor. Avram, welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. A pleasure to be here.
Avraham, please tell us about Abigail Rock, your sister. Tell us about her life and her family.
Abigail Rock, my younger sister, born in 1971, New York City. She was born in 1971 in Tucson, Arizona. And my father, my family moved to Atlanta, Georgia. My father had an opportunity to serve as rabbi there. We came to Israel in 1976, and from a very young age, she was always, my parents are both scholars. My parents both like learning and both like teaching. A Tanakh, is the Hebrew Bible, what the Testament, or what Christians call the Old Testament, and my parents are scholars of Bible, of Talmud, and our house was a very scholarly house. The stories that we grew up on were the stories of the Bible and the stories of the Talmud. And we had a chance to meet the great teachers of Tanakh, of Bible in Israel at the time. A known name was Professor Nechama Leibowitz. Nechama Leibowitz was a teacher of Tanakh who both Abigail and I had a chance to learn from. Abigail has a daughter, Nechama, who is named after Nechama Leibowitz, the late scholar who really impacted the way people learn. And then as she grew up, she became more and more interested in learning and in teaching. Her passion was teaching, and that was a passion that she and I shared. I'm a technology guy. I work in high tech. I develop software, but as fulfillment for meaning, I like teaching, and mainly I like teaching Tanakh. I teach Tanakh in my community, in the local synagogue. I teach Tanakh to various study groups, and I teach Tanakh sometimes to teachers of Tanakh in order to Tanakh. When I say the word Tanakh, Tanakh is Hebrew for Bible. It's the acronym of Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim, the law, the prophets, the writings, and when it's acronized, so we pronounce it Tanakh, Bible. Bible in Hebrew means the book, and that's not a word that's often used in Hebrew. Sorry, Bible in English means the book or book. In Hebrew, we call it, again, Tanakh. So Abigail and I would share that passion. We would talk a lot about teaching methods, about ideas in teaching, about challenges that teachers face. And she has 5 children, one of whom is married, 2 of whom are on the way to being married. I'm still in close touch with her family. She passed away from cancer about 3 years ago. Her third, the anniversary of her passing, what we call in Hebrew sometimes the yahrzeit, the anniversary of her passing is coming up, and we miss her terribly. We miss her terribly, terribly. I still have 2 very, very healthy parents who have continued on in life. She had cancer for a long time prior. She was in and out of remission for 10 years before she passed on. And during those 10 years, we actually became very, very close, and we had a chance to explore other aspects of learning and teaching. Maybe later on in this podcast, I'll have a chance to talk about that as well. So that's me and my younger and wiser sister, Abigail.
Now, Abigail also profoundly inspired many students as a teacher of Torah. Would you give us an impression of her devotion and teaching of Torah?
Well, so her devotion, and this is a thing that students remember. Anybody that ever taught a student knows that deeply, deeply fulfilling experience when you look into the eyes of a student and you see a reflection of understanding, that they actually understand what you mean, and the person who you're talking to grasps it. It's unbelievably fulfilling, and especially if it's material that you're passionate about. And she that gave her deep fulfillment. She taught when she was very, very sick. And many of her students remember her lying on a couch, very, very ill. But the combination of cancer and chemotherapy could wreak havoc on one's body. We don't wish it on anybody, but it really takes a toll from your being. And Abigail would still teach, and students would come to her house, or she would come to class, and she would even teach for a short while. And we celebrate in a week's time. We celebrate Jerusalem Day. Jerusalem Day is the day that in 1967 Jerusalem was liberated. And on Jerusalem Day, Abigail used to like teaching the psalm "Ask for the Peace of Jerusalem." And Abigail had insights about the song for "Ask for the Peace of Jerusalem." May your loved ones rest in peace. And she hadn't taught for a few months already because she was very, very sick, and she actually passed away less than a month later. But she had requested to teach, and she said, "I really want to teach this chapter yet once again." And she was able to convey the community and the students. And the recording is available online. If you go to the Abigail's website, which if you could perhaps share in the meeting in the podcast notes, you'll be able to find Abigail's lecture in Hebrew and in English on the Psalm of "Ask for the Peace of Jerusalem." A beautiful, beautiful lesson that she was passionate about teaching. And every Jerusalem Day, when we commemorate the victory of 1967, we actually learn the chapter and talk about ideas that Abigail had taught us about that chapter. So that's a thing about her dedication to teaching and her dedication to her students. There is one particular method or area of teaching that was important to her. If it's okay, I'd like to share with our listeners. Abigail is always very fascinated, like many teachers of Tanakh, by the story part of the Bible, mainly Mainly, we would talk about, let's say, Genesis and Exodus, where there's a great deal of story narrative. And one of the issues that scholars or people that have read Bibles from a very, very young age, a problem we face is, and many of the audience, I'm sure, will sympathize with this, is we no longer have that experience of the primal reading, the first time that you're reading something. It's been spoiled for us in some sense. We are unable to experience that charm of reading it the first time. So if I open my book in Genesis, and it came to be after these things that the Lord, the Elohim, tested Abraham. Now I know the story ends well, and it's okay. I don't have the drama about it. And we read about Joseph and his brothers stripped him of his garment, the garment with the stripes, let's say, and they threw him into the pit and they sold him to the Ishmaelites. It's hard for me to get worked up about it because I have already read the story so many times that I know that it has a happy ending. He gets reunited with the family and he meets his father again, and they live happily ever after until Exodus. And that is something that we miss. We miss, you know, because we like, if we ever go to a movie or read a book, I don't want anybody to spoil it for me and spoiler alert and tell me what the end of the book or the movie is. And one way in which we can get back that primal reading is when we learn with students who have never experienced the story. So if you learn with your children or with your students, and for them it's new, then by proxy it's new for you. Because if you're a good teacher and you have a good, and you try to get into your student's head and you try to understand what she is now experiencing, then for a fleeting moment, you're reading it again for the first time. And it's a wonderful, wonderful feeling because you're now experiencing it again by proxy through your students' soul to some sense. And so when Abigail would teach, she would teach every chapter as though it's the first time she's teaching the chapter. And that's a wonderful gift many teachers do not have. And she would experience it with the students. It's like almost reading when you go to a movie with your child and your child is seeing it for the first time, then you're seeing it for the first time in some sense. And she would teach like that. And when she taught teachers, she would often emphasize the value of experiencing it for the first time. So she would warn against, and it came to be after these things that God tested Abraham, or God tried Abraham, never ever say, and it came after these things that God only tested Abraham. Or God just tested Abraham. You don't know that he just tested Abraham. I mean, you know it because you read the story already. And the story is just. And teachers, out of habit or out of ritual, might let a word like that slip in. And it came to be after these things that God was just testing Abraham. In the end, you know, Isaac survived the ordeal. So she warned against, when teaching the story and when reading the words and when translating the words and interpreting the words, do not let your knowledge of the end of the story creep in. When teaching Tanakh, when teaching Bible to non-Hebrew speakers, Abigail and me, and we would talk about this a lot, it was one of the topics that we were very interested in, were aware of the difference between translation and interpretation. And it's a fuzzy line. And it's not easy to always stay on the line of interpretation, of translation. And one might even argue that every translation is an interpretation, and there's almost no way to avoid it. And the best you could do is at least be aware. Be aware of when you are translating and when you are interpreting. There's a verse in Kings, which in Hebrew is highly, highly compact. Al yitalel choger kimfateach. And in English, we translate it as, let not he who is buckling his belt be as pride as he who is unbuckling his belt, and or something like that. A belt meaning his war vest or his something like that. And in Hebrew, it's a highly, highly compact, and it really delivers a punch. And in English, it sounds a little clumsy. So we have to find another way, perhaps, to interpret that that line of let not he who is putting on his war garment be as proud or be as self-confident as the gentleman who's undoing his work. So that's just a few examples.
Turning now to Abigail's recently published book, Great Biblical Commentators, how did this unique book come together and what was her goal in writing it?
So there is an institute in Israel called the Herzog Institute for Research at Homs. And they publish a weekly newsletter or a series of weekly newsletters. And they knew that Abigail was doing her research on a medieval Spanish scholar named Ibn Caspi, the son of Caspi, literally the son of silver. And he was a person that provided an exegesis or a commentary on the Bible, mainly on the book of Genesis. And Abigail wrote her PhD. And at some point she was approached by this institute and they said, well, you have such interesting things to say about all the scholars. Why don't you write as part of your monthly newsletter? And it's a monthly newsletter that was written originally in Hebrew. About each month, write about a different commentator. It went through a year long. And I actually have a special feeling towards this one because a lot of the material we researched together and we discussed together, and I would review her raw notes. And this went over for about a year. I think there are about 12 or 13 commentators. And then she was approached by Maggid Press, or Koren Press, the Hebrew equivalent, the Hebrew, and asked to compile it into a book about the commentators. And so that's how the book came into being. And it's a very, very special book because what it does is it goes as each commentator, and Abigail believed, and I agree with her on this one, the commentary provided by the commentator is highly influenced by his biography. And that's a good thing. It doesn't taint the commentary, or it doesn't degrade it to say, well, he's letting his personal life into it. It elevates it. I mean, if a person comes and learns Bible with his whole being, so each commentator she would to the limit of her ability research their biography, maybe in what academies did they learn. Or who were their teachers or their mentors? What did they do for a living? How did they influence things? How did they perceive themselves? How did they perceive the Torah, the law, the Tanakh? And through that, the lens, try to understand their perspective. So you mentioned, before the talk, you mentioned Nachmanides. Nachmanides, in Hebrew, we call him Ramban, Rabbi Moses, son of Nachman, hence the name Nachmanides, and he wrote a commentary on the entire Tanakh, and a very, very insightful commentary. And one of the things we know about Ramban lived in the Spanish city of Barcelona. At the time, it was Catalonia. And he desperately wanted to visit the Holy Land. He wanted to live in Israel. And at the end of his days, he did live in Israel. And that has a very, very strong influence on his commentary. Whenever he translates the book of Genesis, which in the Ramban's opinion is a book about, we commonly say it's a book about the birth of the world, the birth of the Jewish people. Ramban, Nachmanides, says it's about the birth of our relationship to Israel. It's a book about how the Jewish people came to Israel and how the Jewish people left Israel and how they one day will come back to Israel. That's a main theme of the Bible, maybe the main theme of the Bible. Now, there's a word in Bereshit, in Genesis, there's a word in the entire Torah. In Hebrew, if we go back to the translations, interpretations, there's a word called Aretz. How would you, Professor Morales, translate the word Aretz?
Land or earth.
Land or earth. And sometimes it means land in the sense of country, like Egypt is called Aretz. Sometimes it is called land in the sense of the platform which grows out fruits and vegetables, right? Sometimes it is Aretz where we build houses and where we walk and where we live. And sometimes Aretz means the land of Israel. The land of Israel is sometimes called the land or the earth. Ramban is highly aware of when this Aretz means one thing or the other. And if you read Nachmanides in the translation, I would suggest when you're reading Nachmanides either in Genesis or in the last two chapters or last three chapters of the book of Levites or in the book of Deuteronomy, notice where the translation is earth or land or country or, and there's a nuance there that that the Ramban Nachmanides, and that very, that a lot of that to an extent is tainted by his view that the Jews live in the Eretz, in Israel, in the Eretz. The Jews are the people that, and that's Nachmanides, and that's one of the things that she was very interested in. It became a book. It was published in Hebrew, I think, about 2.5 years ago. It became published in English only very, very recently. I hope, I haven't read the translation, only I reviewed one or two chapters. It is my wish, my hope, that the translation actually captures the richness and nuance. It's hard to write a book like that, to translate it. It's hard to write a book like that. It's hard to translate a book like that. So saying, I'm hoping that the people that are listeners, those of us that are fortunate enough to come across this book and be able to study this book, it's not a book you read, it's a book you study. Those of us that are fortunate enough to study this book, to read it slowly. And I would suggest the way that you study it is, perhaps a way to study it might be to read the chapter, but on occasion, actually open the commentary. If you have access to Hebrew, that's best. If you don't, then try to find an English translation of the commentary and read the commentary inside in context, see how it looks. It'll give you a certain feeling for the magic of what those wonderful exegetists or commentators are trying to provide us. She did not treat them as dead. Rashi, Nachmanides, Unkelus, the translator, they're not dead. They're very, very much alive, and we learn from them, and they teach us, and we argue with them, we negotiate with them, we ask them to explain things using different words. They're very, very much alive. Those of us that have had the misfortune, perhaps of losing a parent or losing a loved one, we know that feeling of, we still have a relationship with them, and we care about them, and we even talk to them, and they. And I'm not getting all wooey here. We really talk to them, and they talk back to us, and we seek guidance for them. You know, if we're more rational, we might say, what would they have said? And if we're a little more spiritually inclined, we actually might say to ourselves, what do they say, or what do they think about that? And Avigail believed that in some very real sense, these commentators are still teaching. So she would be very comfortable with the phrase, not Rashi said, or Nachmanides said in the past tense, but Nachmanides says, or Rashi says. Rashi teaches us that, Nachmanides teaches us that. And she was aware, Avigail, my sister, that when you say Rashi teaches us that, it's using the present sense, not as a manner of speaking, of course, but as a manner of thinking, or conceptualizing the way our relationship to the commentators.
Avraham, would you give us an example from the book of some of her helpful insights on a commentator?
So I'll talk about Rashi. Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo, son of Isaac. In Hebrew, he's called Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchak, but he's known in the vernacular as Rashi. And Rashi is one of the earliest, some consider him the first commentator on the Bible. Before him, Rashi was preceded by Unkelus, which is a linear translation, and by the Talmud and Medrash, Midrash, which is an extra level of oral narrative that accompanies the Bible, but it's Rashi that actually has a linear commentator verse by verse on the Bible. That's Rashi. That's what he brought to the table. He's considered the first of the commentators. And Rashi and Abigail, I think, has three chapters about Rashi. He's really the most influential commentator. And most Jews, when you learn Torah, when you learn Bible, when you learn the book, the law, and you have a verse that's challenging, or you're not clear, you say, let's see what Rashi says. What does Rashi say? Rashi is the default, is the go-to. And the children, when they learn in school, you learn Bible, you learn Chumash with Rashi. You learn the Bible, the Pentateuch with Rashi. That's the default. So she wrote a great deal about Rashi. And there's an interesting question. Did Rashi have that historical perspective? Did he know that his translation is going to be what it was, or was he just writing a local commentary? And it seems that Rashi was really thinking from a very wide perspective, and from a very long, and he saw himself not only as a translator, but as an educator. For instance, there is a skin ailment in the Bible called tzara'at, psoriasis. It's called leprosy. It's commonly used, but it's not, at least in many, according to many students of the Bible, it's not what a dermatologist today might call leprosy. It is a sign or punishment from God for certain violations, and it manifests itself in a white, a very, very white as snow skin. It could happen to a person's entire body, or it could happen to one limb. Usually it happens, if you read Bible, either on your hand or on your forehead, but it could happen anywhere on one's body. It's called leprosy tzara. And the Midrash says that leprosy happens for a wide variety of reasons. It happens, I think the Midrash enumerates 11 reasons for which one could get leprosy. Rashi mentions one reason for which you get leprosy. According to Rashi, you get leprosy for lashon hara, for speaking evil against fellow men, either as a collective or as an individual. And every time that leprosy is mentioned, or many times when leprosy is mentioned in the Bible, Rashi says leprosy is about lashon hara, literally the bad tongue or the evil tongue, but it's a figurative manner of speech, speaking evil about other people. And Abigail claims that because Rashi had this aversion to lashon hara, to evil speak, and Rashi was very, very careful, he used this selective quoting of the Midrash, of the interpretation, in order to... So anybody that learns Chumash with Rashi, if you catch him on the street and you say, what is leprosy about? They will say, oh, leprosy, that's for speaking bad about other people. It's obvious, it's taken for granted, it's the only reason that many of us know. There's a Midrash that has another 10 reasons. But because of Rashi, and Avigal points out, it's because Rashi that we know that leprosy, that disease comes about from lashon hara. So that's like an example of an insight that she has about a particular commentator's attitude.
So did Avigal have a few favorites among the commentators?
That's an interesting question. Now, if somebody would ask you, as a parent, who was your favorite child, you would be very, very careful to answer that, you know, when you would consider a question like that. If you're a good parent, the proper answer is, nope, I love everybody the same. But maybe if you're more nuanced, you would say, I love him for his quick wit, and I love her for her diligence, and I love him for his discipline, and I love her for the way he honors his parents, or whatever it is. The generic statement of "I love all my kids the same," you know, might not sound very convincing to your kids, or might not sound very convincing to. So, Abigail loved all the commentators the same, but she loved certain aspects about each commentator. She loved Rashi for his simplicity, for his Rashi is very, very short, and it's obvious that, or obvious to me, to her, that Rashi spent a great deal of time, and Rashi does not write very long. He writes very, very concise. And anybody that has tried to written a very concise email or letter knows how hard it is to write short. It's easy to write long. Rashi is short. She likes Rashi because he's short. And Rashi speaks to you. You could imagine that Rashi is talking to you. She liked Abravanel. Abravanel, I don't know if it's been translated into English. Do you know, Professor Morales? Has Abravanel been translated into English? Don Isaac Abravanel.
Yes, his Torah commentary was translated by Rav Israel Lazar.
So Abravanel, he had a flair for drama. He liked reading the stories. He liked asking the question about the stories. Rashi, when Rashi analyzes the stories, Rashi rarely asks the question, why did they do what they do? Rashi just believes the Torah tells us what people did, and that's what they did. And the Torah doesn't tell us. It's almost like watching a movie. When you watch a movie, you just watch what the characters do. You rarely know what the characters think. You have to infer that from their behavior. And you rarely know it why they did what they did, as opposed to reading a novel, let's say, where the novelist is omniscient, so the novel could tell you what a person felt or what a person believed and why they did what they did. The Bible only tells us what they did. So if I ask a question like, why didn't Yosef, Joseph, who was in Egypt, why didn't he send a message to his father saying, hey, Dad, I'm alive, I'm safe? Reasonable question. Rashi never asked it because Rashi didn't feel that the question of why somebody did
or didn't do a particular thing is a question that we can answer or that we might want to answer. Rashi does that occasionally. I'm generalizing. Rashi does that occasionally, but not always. And Abarbanel asks that question. Ramban asks that question. Abarbanel tries to get into the character's head and discuss it. Abigail taught a lot about Joseph. Joseph was very interesting to her. And Abarbanel, who was a finance minister to King Ferdinand during the expulsion of the Jews in the Great Inquisition in 1492. In 1496, Abarbanel saw himself as a Joseph, as a person who has influence in the in the royalty in the king's house, and who is his finance minister, and still has to be loyal to his family's faith and to his father's faith. And she was very charmed by that, by a person who's able to see his own biography reflected through the biography of a biblical character like Joseph. So that's Abarbanel. Ibn Ezra, Moses, son of Ezra, Moses Ibn Ezra, a Spanish commentator who came about 100 and some years after Rashi. He was very, very sharp-witted, quick-witted. He liked plays on words. He was bitter. He was cynical. He had a biting humor. And Abigail appreciated that humor about him. So those are just a few examples of no favorite, but maybe Rashi.
Before we let you go, Avraham, can you tell us if there are any further works from Abigail to be published?
So Abigail wrote her PhD on a commentator, a medieval commentator. There's also a chapter about him in the book called Ibn Caspi. Ibn was the title that the Spanish scholars took, son of Ibn Caspi. Who lived in medieval Spain. So that PhD is going to be hopefully compiled into a book and maybe translated into English one day. She gave many, many lectures, a lot of which are in English. And if you look through the website, and I highly recommend it, you see a very dynamic and energetic teacher. And if you follow the years, unfortunately, you'll be able to also see the decline in one's health. And those maybe somebody will transcribe them or follow up on them. I teach Bible quite a bit, and I quote Abigail a lot, and I quote ideas and discussions that we have had. Towards the end of her life, Abigail became very interested in discussing death. That's something that people that are end of their lives contemplate. So we learned the book of Ecclesiastes together. The book of Ecclesiastes, in Hebrew we call it Kohelet, is the book that discusses, especially the last chapter, the very, very sad, heartbreaking last chapter about a person reaching the end of their days. And there was a statement that we discussed a lot. Actually, Jacob makes the statement when he sees Joseph after the first time for many years. After Joseph is sold, is taken away, and he has surely been eaten by a wild beast, and Jacob refuses to accept condolences, he makes a very upsetting statement. He says, I will die, I will go down to Sheol, that's translated as hell, I will go down to hell as a sad, bitter man. He doesn't seek comfort, he doesn't seek, and all his sons and all his daughters come up and try to comfort him, but he refuses to find comfort. That means he's a person who is living terrible, terrible tragedy. And when he sees Joseph, he says, a statement, he says, I am willing to die, or this time I am now ready to die. I am no longer afraid of dying. I'm now interpreting a bit. I'm no longer afraid of dying because I see your face. And we discussed at length that idea that when a person sees her or his children's face, he is no longer afraid of dying. That is a very, very powerful statement. And the suggestion or interpretation that I offered is, And I discussed this with Abigail, and it's an idea that we'd like to expand on perhaps one day. When we die, everything about us dies. Our flesh, our bones, our body fluids, our body parts, nothing is left, except that drop of genetic material that became our child continues to live after we die. There's one little tiny part of mommy and daddy that continues to grow and live on even after a person has died and their body is decomposing and be reclaimed by the earth. because you are dust and you will return to dust. And it says actually in the chapter in Genesis that after God tells Adam, you will work the land with the sweat of your brow or the sweat of your face until your dying day, for you are earth and you will return to earth. What does Adam do? It says, and Adam knew Eve, his wife, and they had a son named Cain. Because he has a way of not dying, at least not dying internally. He's going to have a child. And that child is going to go, right, Adam, Seth, Enosh, down to Avram Pupko and Michael Morales. There is a continuation. There is life. So so that's like an idea that she took deeply and took deep comfort. And I said, Abigail, you're able to look into your children's faces, and they came from you. And they're going to continue living after you and I are no longer here. So that's the parting thought. That's just something I was eager to share with you about my sister, the author of the book, about the commentators who I miss terribly. And again, thank you very much for this opportunity. It's been a pleasure to meet you and the pleasure to share some of these thoughts with you. Thank you.
Avraham, thank you for being with us and sharing about Abigail Rock's life and work.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. It was a pleasure to be with here and meet you and meet your audience.
Friends, you've been listening to New Books in Jewish Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. Until next time, goodbye.